This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In the past week, the COVAX facility has delivered over 5 million doses to African countries. I was saddened to read that three times as many doses have been thrown away in the United States alone.
That's Matshidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, on how Africa still lags behind the world's richest nations in inoculating its people for COVID-19. Details coming up. Also, the military junta that seized power in Guinea has ordered all banks to freeze all government accounts. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The World Health Organization says genomic sequencing capability is being improved in Africa to better detect, monitor, and respond to COVID-19 mutations. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Several variants of the coronavirus are circulating in African countries. The Delta variant is by far the most contagious and virulent. The variants have sparked flare-ups of this deadly disease. However, the Delta variant is most responsible for prolonging Africa's third pandemic wave. The World Health Organization says Africa's COVID-19 third wave is now tapering off after a two-month surge, with the number of new cases decreasing by 23% last week. The World Health Organization says the caseload remains extremely high, though, with more than 165,000 new weekly cases reported. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, says the WHO is supporting countries in scaling up pathogen surveillance through genome sequencing. She says together with the South African National Bioinformatics Institute, the WHO is launching a new regional center of excellence for genomic surveillance in Cape Town.
Knowing which variants are circulating and where is critical for informing effective response operations. The continent lags far behind the rest of the world when it comes to sequencing, accounting for only 1% of over 3 million COVID-19 sequences conducted worldwide. So this groundbreaking initiative aims to initially support 14 Southern African countries to scale up their genomic sequencing by 15-fold each month.
Moeti says analysis will shed light on the pathways COVID-19 is using to spread into communities. On the vaccine front, she notes Africa still lags far behind the world's richer nations in inoculating its inhabitants.
In the past week, the COVAX facility has delivered over 5 million doses to African countries. I was saddened to read that three times as many doses have been thrown away in the United States alone, 15 million doses since March 2021. This is enough vaccines to cover everyone over 18 years in Liberia, Mauritania, and the Gambia, for example.
Moeti says high-income countries have not kept their pledges to share 1 billion doses globally. So far, she says only 120 million doses have been released. She notes only 3% of the continent's 1.2 billion people are fully vaccinated. She says Africa has passed the sad milestone of 200,000 lives lost to the coronavirus, lives that could have been saved had they received a dose of the vaccine. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Zimbabwean court has ordered that the body of the late Zimbabwean leader, Robert Mugabe, be exhumed from reburial at the National Heroes Shrine in Harare. Mugabe was buried in the courtyard of the rural family home in 2019 after weeks of dispute with the government, which wanted to have his remains in the shrine. Over the past several days, the president and prime minister of Somalia have been openly feuding over who has the power to appoint cabinet ministers and top security officials. To get the details of what's been going on, my colleague Kate Bond-Dawson spoke with Mohamed Olad, a senior editor and reporter with VOA's Somali service. He says the dispute has been building for months behind the scenes.
Kate, over the past several days, the cancer has been on the edge as President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo and Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble clashed over the firing of Fahd Yassin, the country's intelligence chief. The two most powerful leaders were locked in a deepening standoff on Wednesday after they named a different name to head the nation's intelligence service. Roble appointed another man, Bashir Mohamed Jama, as an interim head of the agency known as NISA. The president called Roble's move unconstitutional, and late on Tuesday named a third man, Yassin Abdullahi Mohamed, to head the agency. So the dispute started and it's still going on.
What is behind this dispute? Has it been going on for quite a while behind the scenes, or was there something new that caused it?
Well, the open row now between the two, meaning is nominally over a matter in investigation. Igran Tahlil, a female 25-year-old officer with NISA, was abducted near her Mogadishu home in June. And last week, her employers concluded that she had been kidnapped and killed by al-Shabaab fighters. Al-Shabaab denied the claim, leading up to the firing of the intelligence chief, Fahd Yassin, former Al Jazeera journalist, who is also in the close circle of the president. But many analysts believe the issue only marks an escalation of months of tension between the two men. Roble and Mohamed clashed in April, when the president unilaterally extended his four-year term by 2 years, prompting army factions loyal to each to seize rival positions in the capital, Mogadishu. The confrontation was resolved when the president put Roble in charge of security and organizing delayed legislative and presidential elections. So it's deeper than the latest dispute. It has been going for some time behind the scenes.
Now, is there any movement or any action being taken to resolve the dispute? And what are the risks if they can't resolve it, if these two gentlemen cannot work together?
Yes, there are ongoing efforts to de-escalate the tension in terms of Somalia's international partners, the United Nations African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, the United States, the European Union, and East African bloc, IGAD, are involved pressing the country's leaders to end their dispute as a matter of urgency. The initial meeting between the two leaders ended fruitless yesterday, but still the shuttle diplomacy and brokerage continue in Mogadishu. And of course, if this issue is not resolved, it will have a huge impact on Somalia's already fragile security, as well as its upcoming parliamentary polls now scheduled to kick off between October 1st and November 25, following months of delays. Any political rift gate in the top of the Somali leaders will also give an opportunity to the al-Shabaab militant group to better mobilize itself and carry out attacks and efforts to disrupt any democratic process and stability in Somalia, including the elections.
That was Mohamed Olad, a senior editor and reporter with VOA Somali Service, speaking with VOA editor Kate Pond-Dawson by phone. The military junta that seized power in Guinea has ordered the central bank and other banks to freeze all government accounts. Reuters reported the freeze is aimed at securing state assets. A mining boom propelled strong economic growth in Guinea during President Alpha Condé's decade of power. But surveys suggest that Guineans thought corruption has increased in recent years, while dissatisfaction with the economy and living conditions has risen. The 15-member Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has condemned the coup and suspended Guinea's membership. The regional group said it was sending a mission to the country to evaluate the situation there and asked for the immediate release of Condé, who was arrested during the takeover. The African Union followed suit and suspended Guinea today. In the Gambia, the fallout from the merger of two major political parties, President Adama Barrow's NPP and the APRC of former dictator Yahya Jammeh, is driving debate. Some say the merger could derail reforms in a nation that just started to rebuild its democratic system and institutions after over 20 years under Jammeh's autocratic rule. Sani Marna is the editor of Alakamba Times, a digital news platform covering Gambian news and politics. He joined International Edition's Jackson Mfungane by phone to talk about the implications of this surprising political merger and what Barrow seeks to gain from the alliance.
What Barrow hoped to gain from the alliance with the APRC is to, you know, seek for re-election, how he's going to win the election, because coming with, forming an alliance with the APRC, a party which still have some base, will, you know, help him to get re-elected in the office. So basically, his intention of the alliance is to get re-elected to next five term in office again.
And how are Gambians generally reacting to this move? How is it shaping debate in the country as they prepare for the first elections post-JAME?
Yeah, since the announcement was made in the weekend, you know, there has been angry reactions from ordinary peoples in the streets of Banjul. You know, even in the rural Gambia, the discussions have been, why is President Barrow's NPP joining forces with a party that refused him to be sworn in the Gambia when JAME refused to step down? Why is President Barrow's party forming an alliance with a party that tormented Gambians, you know, for 22 years? And now Gambians are seeking justice. They are seeking reform of the institutions that were damaged. Why is the president, instead of focusing on building the transitional justice institution that include bringing JAME to justice, will now, you know, turn around to form an alliance with someone he is trying to prosecute or he's trying to investigate?
And what is the likelihood that JAME could return to the country after or before these elections? Has he given any hints or publicly expressed intentions of returning to the Gambia?
Yes, JAME has always been expressing intention of returning to the Gambia. There were a couple of times when media report claimed that JAME will return to Gambia on so-so date. And this announcement were made by JAME's own party that JAME will be coming to the Gambia. This was almost three times when the party came openly saying they're going to the airport to welcome JAME, you know, to come. And the saddest part of the entire alliance, you know, according to the APRC, there was an MOU that was signed between the NPP, Barrow's party, and the former President JAME's APRC party. And the content of this MOU, there was a document that was being circulated online saying one of the conditions of the MOU is to ensure the safe return of former President Yahya Jammeh to the Gambia, and also giving the APRC at least five cabinet positions should President Barrow win the re-election, and also a vice president position. But the NPP came, you know, out, you know, saying that the content of that document that has been circulated is not true, but they refuse to, you know, release the content of the MOU. And people like me are still investigating. Yesterday, I spoke to a legal person in Banjul. He told me the circulated MOU is well drafted, and he believes this is even drafted by a legal person from the Justice Ministry. So they are just denying the content of it because Gambians are so angry with the, you know, content or the forming of an alliance with APRC, but now, it has been circulating. And key among them is the return of JAME, and also to give back JAME's asset, you know, when he returned to the Gambia, and to give his party five ministerial positions, including the vice president role.
Sani Marna is the editor of Alakamba Times, a digital platform covering Gambian news and politics. He was speaking with VOA's Jackson Mfungane. Drug abuse in Zimbabwe has evolved over the years, and now harder drugs are being sold on the streets. In a country with high unemployment and a youthful population, drug abuse has become an avenue of escape for many. The government is moving in to fight the growing problem. Reporter Kunzai Zanowashi has the details.
Nick Mangwana, the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Information, recently wrote about the government's move to crack down on drug abuse. His tweet read, "Having noted the serious adverse effects substance abuse is having on both individual health and societal well-being, President Emmerson Mnangagwa has set up an interministerial committee on tackling the substance abuse menace among the youths. Plot Marco, a podcaster, offers his reaction to the announcement. He is the director of Jibiliga Dance Trust, a non-profit organization which uses hip-hop culture to keep drugs off the streets.
I think this is a very commendable development, a very long overdue one, and I hope that it is definitely going to help curb the spread of the substance abuse pandemic. My hope is that they're going to be very effective because the drug loads are known, the entry points are known, and there's going to be stern measures for anyone who's found selling drugs, especially to young people. Also, stakeholders from within the community need to be part and parcel of this, from your churches, families, communities, schools, and civic organizations need to also participate in this.
Wilson Box is with Zimbabwe Civil Liberties and Drug Network, which works with drug users and addicts. He says common drugs in the streets include marijuana, crystal meth known as motoriro, pethidine, diazepam, glue, and many alcohol-based illicit drinks. He adds that most of the drugs come through the country's porous borders from South Africa and Malawi. He explains to VOA that the approach towards fighting drug abuse is one that needs careful consideration.
What I would want to advise this committee is not to take the issue of illicit drug use from a criminal point of view. The moment we do that, we actually lose it. We believe that the issue of illicit drug use in Zimbabwe is a public health issue, and it should be taken as such. People who use drugs, most of them, they are victims of circumstances.
He adds that an estimated 30% of the country's youth use crystal meth. While some drug lords are known, they are politically connected and have enough protection to keep their operations running and secure freedom in the society. Health officials say if these efforts begin to yield results, then the crime rates in communities are expected to decrease. Box says a drug-free society will be difficult to achieve, but the effort should aim towards managing and ensuring drugs do not devastate a whole generation. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
Using feature phones and homemade wooden tablets brings a new meaning to e-learning and perhaps bridging the digital divide that affects most rural Malawi. Thanks to the genius of Sam Masikidi, an app developer who has designed an offline mobile learning app, Inspire, to make e-learning more widely accessible for schools in remote villages. Africa 54's technology correspondent Paul Ndiho, via Spike, spoke to Sam Masakini, technical lead, Inspire Learn team in Lilongwe, Malawi.
A lot of your friends, a lot of people talk about you as somebody who is on the verge of becoming the next Bill Gates in Malawi. You've literally come up with your own way of helping young people. You are doing some amazing things on the ground. Let's start there.
Thank you so much. Well, I mean, it's quite humbling to hear those remarks. Main specifically, my main inspiration is trying to help fellow youth in some of the most pressing challenges that we face on a national level. So my background can also serve as a big testimony because I actually come from a humble background. So due to so much circumstances to the state of education in Malawi, there's quite a small number that is privileged to attend schools or get access to quality education. So we've had two technologies that we're currently also working on. When I say we, I simply mean me and my small team. And we're working on providing access to, you know, reading resources, learning resources on feature phones. So these are basic mobile phones. So students get to access content that is rich in media. You have images, you have video clips, you have text there and audios. So we are doing this at the cost of no internet at all. So you find out that even students in rural areas of the nation are able to be included in such an initiative.
You said earlier that you use feature phones to do what you do. How about the cost of those phones? How are they able to afford some of those phones? They might not be as expensive as smartphones, but they're still expensive for ordinary people.
That's very true. I mean, the main reason why we selected to start with feature phones is because they're widely available to most of the local Malawians. But then you find out that there'll still be a certain group of people that cannot fit in the margin that you were projecting. So for such particular people, we have another different device that we think might be of use. We're making tablet computers that can be used by three or four people at a time, so that they do not get the burden of having each one, you know, getting the cost of trying to make use of that same thing.
Did I hear you correctly? You said that you are making tablets?
We are making tablet computers. So we're basically using IoT. I don't know if this is too technical, but it's basically us assembling a few parts, and then forming up something, and then properly packaging it with some content. So we started with making them out of wood. We are now moving to trying to recycle plastic and make them out of plastic. And one of the best features about them is they're solar powered. So you'd find about three or four being powered with one small sized panel. So this one is to actually address to a bit of a larger number of students rather than having one basic home. We'd have a digital literacy lab in a village that does not have a facility to safely secure desktop computers or even the capacity to power and sustain themselves for any digital literacy program that they may be having.
Speaking about those tablets, do you program them in your local languages or it's all like one size fits all, English?
Our main goal is to actually encompass or actually also embrace our own heritage itself. So for us, we actually saw it, well, you know, best fitting to include that aspect of our local languages in some of the programs. But you see, most of that is falling to the part where we have to work with teachers to produce the content, the learning materials together. So on our end, customizing on the software systems wouldn't be much of a problem. But then it's about the content that we have to include in the package itself that we have to constantly work. So I would say yes, we are working with our local languages for the most part.
That was Africa 54's tech correspondent Paul Ndiho speaking to Sam Masikini in Lilongwe, Malawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Voice of America's global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.